Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, December the 12th. This program, this hour, is in response to a listener suggestion during my last open line, and because our guest wrote a recent cover story on this issue for Foreign Policy magazine. The issue is the war on drugs, a war that continues to fail, according to our guest, and should be replaced with a smarter drug control regime that values reality over rhetoric. Should drugs be legalized? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Ethan Nadelman, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and he's author of the cover story in the September-October issue of Foreign Policy magazine, called Legalize It, Why It's Time to Just Say No to Prohibition. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So we have a listener who, every time I open the lines up and ask for suggestions, wants me to do something on this topic. And then I found your article in Foreign Policy magazine. Why is now the time to say no to prohibition?
Well, I think it's been true for many years. It's just that the war on drugs keeps getting more and more onerous, more and more costly. It keeps causing more and more destruction without any serious evidence that it's really working better. You know, in 1980, there were about 50,000 people behind bars on any one night for violating a drug law. Today, there's almost 500,000 people in the United States tonight behind bars for a nonviolent violation of a drug law. We lock up in the United States more people for violating a drug law than all of Western Europe locks up for everything, and they have over 100 million more people than we do. And if you put that in the broader context, that the United States is the world's leading incarcerator, that we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's incarcerated population, just start there and say that the time has come to reconsider drug prohibition.
Yeah, and we have people serving longer sentences for crack cocaine than cocaine. What do you think of that?
Well, as you saw in the last couple of days, both first the U.S. Supreme Court 2 days ago and then the U.S. Sentencing Commission yesterday, both basically said that that needs to be changed. The fact that it took them 20 years, I mean, back as, you know, to change that is a real tragedy and a shame and a bit of a farce, but at least there's finally some serious motion that's going to benefit thousands and ultimately tens of thousands of people who are serving unjustly long sentences behind bars. Now, mind you, that's only affecting the federal courts and the federal prisons, so a lot of action still needs to happen in the states as well.
Yeah. Well, besides the incarceration issue, why should we legalize a product that that can hurt people?
Yeah, well, let me put it, I should also clarify a bit. Mm-hmm. The title of my article actually was not Legalize. The title of the article was Drugs, Think Again. And the editors gave it the title Legalize It because mm-hmm. they thought that would be more provocative. Now, in fact, my argument about this has been that when it comes to marijuana, the argument for legalization is pretty overwhelming. I mean, here you're talking about a drug that is, for the vast majority of people who use it, less dangerous than alcohol. You're talking about all the arguments in favor of marijuana prohibition being like those against alcohol prohibition, but even stronger. You're talking about the fact that 800,000 people were arrested in the United States last year for marijuana offenses, almost 90% for possession. You're talking about the fact that tens of millions of people have used this drug, that in recent years it's been hard to find a presidential candidate who would say that they had not mm-hmm. smoked marijuana, that there's an incredible hypocrisy around this stuff, and that the overwhelming argument always used against legalizing marijuana, which is that we need to protect the kids, is utterly a farce. I mean, if you ask yourself the question, who has the best access to marijuana in America today, it's teenagers. And who had the best access 10 or 20 or 30 years ago? It was teenagers. So we have a policy which is clearly failing, which is clearly doing more harm than good, and where the benefits of making it legal, whether we're talking about moving in the direction of the Dutch with their coffee shop system, or whether you're talking about it treating more like alcohol, for example, in tough regulation states, say Utah, New Hampshire, what have you, where the benefits would be saving tens of billions of dollars, perhaps, in tax revenue on enforcing a failed law. potentially tens of billions of dollars in tax revenue, and with the risk of increased drug use and abuse being fairly minimal. So I think the argument of marijuana is overwhelming. With respect to the other drugs, my argument there really is that I don't know what the answer is, and most people don't know what the answer is. But to assume that we need to keep the drug prohibition laws in place simply because they've been there for the last 50 or 70 or 80 years is an inherently conservative position that embraces the status quo simply because it is the status quo, and that closes one's eyes to the incredible devastation being wrought by drug prohibition all around the world.
We are talking about the war on drugs, the failing or failed war on drugs, according to our guest, Ethan Nadelman. He is founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. We're talking about his arguments in his cover story for Foreign Policy magazine on drugs and drug prohibition. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 17 minutes past 7 o'clock. Coming up this afternoon after 2 o'clock, something we just talked about. On Talk of the Nation, the United States Sentencing Commission has voted to reduce punishments for crimes related to crack cocaine retroactively. Some 20,000 federal inmates could have their sentences adjusted and have earlier release dates. That's going to be discussed after 2 o'clock this afternoon on Talk of the Nation. We are talking with the founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, author of a recent cover story on this issue for Foreign Policy magazine. He is answering your questions and responding to your views on what he calls a smarter drug control program that values reality over rhetoric, and why he says it's time to replace the war on drugs. Cowboy in Madison is our first caller. Hi, you're on the air. Cowboy.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that they shouldn't be legalizing drugs. At least, there are a lot of drugs out there that should never be legalized. But, you know, when you're talking medical marijuana for medical purposes to help cancer patients, that's one thing. My other point is that they won't need to legalize drugs if they enforce the law fairly and evenly without consideration to cultural bias or race or class, because having been in law enforcement, I know that the cops are spending more time wherever you have a ghetto, wherever you got poor people all crowded into one area. You're going to have aggressive enforcement, and that means they're going to try taking them guys off the street any way they can, and that's why a lot of innocent people are getting caught up in this thing, and that's why a lot of families are getting ruined, and a lot of people are getting locked up. That's why we got 50,000 people locked up right, 250,000 people locked up right now. Most of them are nonviolent, low-level offenders. And I'll take my, you can respond to that if you want to, but that's the truth.
Well, yeah, I don't think you're going to disagree with that necessarily, are you, Ethan?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, Cowboy makes a couple of good points. The first one is on the issue of medical marijuana. I and my organization have been deeply involved in the efforts around the country to make marijuana legal, at least for medical purposes. And I would say that among the people who have supported that, half of them support it simply because they're interested purely in the medical issue, and they don't support the broader legalization of marijuana. And the other half basically think we should, you know, go further, that the best way to protect not just patients but everybody else as well is to remove the marijuana prohibition laws. But yeah, and I think his other point as well is that, of course, there's huge racial disproportionality and prejudice in the enforcement of these laws. That's part of what the U.S. Supreme Court and the Sentencing Commission were addressing in the last couple of days. But I think it's always been the case that whenever you have an oppressive law, it's going to be disproportionately enforced against the people who are powerless, the people who are poor. You know, I mean, you go back to the early part of this century. You had many black Americans back in the teens and the 20s or before that supported alcohol prohibition because they saw the same evils with alcohol that other people saw. They saw all the abuse and the addiction and all of this sort of stuff. But lo and behold, once you made alcohol illegal, where were the laws enforced more harshly? Then as today, against people who were poor, people who were, people of color and what have you. Now, where I think Cowboy gets it wrong is in thinking that if somehow if you enforce these laws better, you would not any longer need to question drug prohibition. And that's a fundamental mistake. I mean, one of the things he's forgetting, it's not just that the enforcement of these laws is racially biased. It's the origins of these laws. I mean, the first anti-opium laws, the first drug prohibition laws in America were directed at Chinese minorities in Nevada and California in the 1870s and 80s. And that was all about racial prejudice. The first anti-cocaine laws, when we first made cocaine illegal in this country, were directed at blacks in the South and Louisiana. You know, where once again the fears over our women and children, and we had to make this stuff illegal. The first anti-marijuana laws were in the teens of the 20s, directed at Mexican-Americans and Mexican migrants who had moved up here, taken good jobs from so-called good white people, go back home, smoke a little reefer, and all of a sudden the local authorities have to make this stuff illegal. So if you ask yourself the question, why do certain drugs land up being regulated, you know, tax controlled, like alcohol, cigarettes, what have you, and why do other drugs land up being made illegal and treated with prison and incarceration? Ultimately, it doesn't have to do with the relative dangers or risks of these drugs. Ultimately, it mostly has to do with who are using these drugs. And the darker the skin color, the lower the class, the more recent their immigration to this country or some other, that's what lands up getting criminalized. This is not about science and health. This is about prejudice deep down and about a widespread cultural fear and ignorance deep down.
Thanks, Cowboy. Omar in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I had just two comments. First of all, I just heard your caller talking again about prohibition and who it benefits or doesn't benefit and the sort of prejudices behind it. But I think he's also missing the fact that it's a huge money-making operation for the police, the criminal gangs, and the prison guards. And those associations are very powerful in any society. And they work to impose these laws and to have this taxpayer money diverted to them. It's not about just prejudice or some moral issue or something. There's very real money involved, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. In all these prison associations and criminal mafias, they make sure these laws are on the books. Mm-hmm. The other comment I had was that I am an immigrant from Pakistan, and when I was growing up, we had legal drugs, and they were available in shops. You could walk by. We would go to school walking past shops that sold opium and sold marijuana, and hardly anybody used those drugs. The people who used them were considered strange and deviant and whatever, and yet it was completely legal, and the government actually made money out of those. And then they prohibited them, and the same thing that's happening here is happening there. You have thousands of people in prison. You have a huge security service that's much more corrupt than the one here and makes huge amounts of money out of it. Now, of course, they get money from the U.S. government for it, so that's another scam.
Omar, thank you for calling. A reaction, Ethan?
Yeah, well, I mean, he basically has it right. I mean, the moral issue's there, but he's exactly right. This is a huge prison industrial complex making tens of billions of dollars off of this. In the United States and also abroad. You know, you go to some states, California, New York, I'm not sure about Wisconsin, the prison guards union is among the most powerful political forces in the state capitals. And you go down south and elsewhere, and it's not the prison guards unions, but it's the prison builders who are incredibly powerful. You look at almost every politician wants a lineup of law enforcement officials behind them. And law enforcement officials are routinely calling for tougher laws. They give lip service to the need for prevention and treatment, but when push comes to the shove, they say, give us more money, give us more power, give us more prisons. So your caller has it right. And when he's talking about what existed in Pakistan, that's also correct. That throughout Asia, both Southwest Asia and Southeast Asia, throughout the 19th and until well into the 20th century, they basically had opium control systems, sort of like methadone maintenance or heroin maintenance systems, where people, generally elderly people or in Southeast Asia, Chinese minorities, could in fact obtain a daily dose of opium. And these things were smoked or eaten or what have you. And the problem was far, far more innocuous than it is today. In their caller's country, in Pakistan, they ultimately banned these things, as they did in Iran, as they did in Southeast Asia. They initially reduced the number of elderly people smoking, but then they were all of a sudden confronted huge increases in heroin, partially because heroin was far more compact, far more lucrative, far more discreet to smoke, far easier to hide. And today, in Pakistan, and for that matter, Iran, their rates of heroin addiction are among the highest in the world, probably higher even than the United States. But it's basically the same failed, corrupt prohibitionist policy that is failing to protect the people who are most vulnerable while exacting all sorts of costs, both from those people and society at large.
Omar, we appreciate your perspective. Now we go to Joan in Shorewood. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I agree 100%. We need to legalize drugs. The system is not working as it presently stands, but I must say this, it's working for some people. It's a moneymaker for some people, and those are the people in high places. If people become addicted to the drugs, if they become legal, we need treatment programs, not imprisonment. The prison system has been privatized, and that's a big moneymaker. If they have a vested interest to keep it filled up with clients, giving them longer and longer sentences. And right now, I believe about 1 in 31 Americans is now in prison or on parole. With the prison system as it is and this the drug system of treating drug use continues, that half of us will be guarding the other half before long. And it simply isn't working. It's an abuse. The largest percentage of people that are in prison are minorities and are poor. Mm-hmm. And with the jobs going overseas, people do turn to drug trading as a means of earning money. If you make the drugs legal, it takes the profit out of it. And also it's filled with hypocrisy. Who exactly is bringing the drugs into the country? Certainly not poor inner city small-time dealers.
Yeah, lots of points there. What about who's bringing the drugs into this country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the caller gets it mostly right. You just have to be careful at overemphasizing the money angle. It's a big piece. The private prison builders and the prison guards unions and, you know, all the legislators in poor and impoverished parts of your state and mine who see prison building as the one thing that will provide jobs to unemployed kids. Basically, as your caller said, you know, you have one group of society with roughly the equivalent education guarding another group of society. You know, to some extent, the biggest housing projects we have for people coming from the inner city are basically upstate prisons to ship them off and have them guarded by people there. When it comes to who's bringing drugs into the country, it's important to understand two things about this. First of all, that ultimately the markets in marijuana, cocaine, heroin, other drugs are global commodities markets, just like alcohol or cigarettes or coffee or sugar or whiskey or precious metals or you name it. These are global commodities markets. And that people who think that somehow we could keep these things out of the country or that somehow there's a way to isolate ourselves from the global economy, I think really just have to think again. The bottom line is that when we try to crack down in one part of the world, it pops up somewhere else. We crack down on opium or heroin coming out of Turkey, it pops up in Colombia, or pops up in Thailand, or pops up in Burma, or pops up in Afghanistan. Crack down on cocaine coming out of Bolivia, pops up in Colombia. Crack down on marijuana somewhere, it pops up somewhere else. And when it comes to who's bringing this stuff into the country, well, I mean, as in any commodities market, there are some people and some companies, in this case illegal, making a lot of money, but ultimately the people bringing this country are typically tens, if not hundreds of thousands of poor people. They're poor peasants, you know, from all around Latin America and Central America. They're poor people in Mexico. They're poor people in Africa. They're poor people willing to, you know, take a chance of swallowing a half a kilo of cocaine or heroin in balloons or condoms and putting in their belly and smuggling into the country. They're people willing to take all sorts of risks, basically, so they can make a few hundred or a few thousand dollars.
And I need to jump in because we're at a news break. We will continue talking after the news with Ethan Nadelman, who is founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, who says the war on drugs is not working. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 on this Wednesday, December the 12th. Is it time to end the war on drugs as we know it? We are talking with a guest who says yes, and he wrote about saying no to drug prohibition in a recent issue of Foreign Policy magazine, the September-October issue. Ethan Nadelman is founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and in his cover story, Drugs, he writes, "Prohibition has failed again. Instead of treating the demand for illegal drugs as a market and addicts as patients, policymakers the world over have boosted the profits of drug lords and fostered narco states that would frighten Al Capone, Finally, a smarter drug control regime that values reality over rhetoric is rising to replace the war on drugs. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. So, Ethan, what is this smarter drug control regime that's replacing the war on drugs?
Well, in the case of marijuana, I think it clearly involves treating it more like alcohol. I mean, it's a policy of taxing the stuff, controlling it, regulating it, try to keep kids from getting in trouble with it, and just basically taking it out of the underground, out of the criminal milieu. With respect to the other drugs, it's really harder to say. I mean, the basic argument I was making in the article and elsewhere is that we need to treat drug addiction far more as a health issue than as a criminal issue. And we need to accept the fact that many people who use illicit drugs are doing no harm whatsoever, either to themselves or anybody else. So I think the basic guidelines would be that if you use drugs and you don't hurt another soul, you should not be the business of the state or your employer or anybody else. Get behind the wheel of a car, yes, then you deserve to be punished. Go out and hurt somebody, yes, you deserve to be punished. But if you're using drugs and not hurt anybody else, that should not be the state's business. Secondly, if you have a problem with drugs, if you're addicted to drugs, think about it the way we do about alcohol or cigarettes. People deserve a helping hand, they deserve compassion, they deserve an opportunity for treatment or rehabilitation or what have you, and they deserve multiple opportunities because we know that trying to get addiction behind you takes many, 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 many efforts. That treating this as a criminal issue instead and throwing people behind bars lands up costing more money and working less effectively. And finally, we need to find ways to try to bring this stuff out of the underground, above ground. I don't know if that means treating it like alcohol or cigarettes. It's hard to see doing that with something like crack cocaine. On the other hand, you look outside the United States, you look around Europe and even in Canada now, and you see that more and more countries are beginning a policy of prescribing pharmaceutical heroin to illicit heroin addicts who are unable to quit by any means. Now, there are all sorts of approaches in which you try to reduce the vitality and the dynamism of the black market and treat this more as a regulated public health issue.
Scott in Menasha is with us now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I think your guest pretty much says it all. When I was a lot younger, I tried marijuana a few times, and I just don't do it anymore. Drugs, nothing. But to make it illegal, you can go drink yourself silly or drink responsibly. You can smoke cigarettes. Why did they pick like marijuana and stuff and to put all these people in jail? And the only reason most people have anything against it is because the government made it illegal. Well, if you think your government's looking out for you, you better wake up. And I would have nothing wrong against legalizing it and responsible. You know, don't be driving and going to work, but just like alcohol and stuff, I would not see a problem with that. And I still wouldn't use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you want to give us a quick history lesson on how marijuana became illegal?
Well, Joanne, as I said before, a lot of it had to do in this country with prejudice against Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, typically you have immigrants coming to... I mean, I should say, even with respect to alcohol prohibition, if you think about that, to some extent that also was about a cultural divide between the white Americans who came to this country in the 18th, early part of the 19th century, and the not-so-white Americans who came in the late 19th and early 20th century from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, what have you. There's always this cultural divide in this thing. When you look at the congressional debates and some of the state legislative debates where they voted to make marijuana illegal in the teens and 20s and 30s, it seems like a Monty Python routine. You cannot believe that elected officials were actually saying this stuff. You can't believe the silliness. You know, we look back at that movie Reefer Madness as a joke movie, but in point of fact, that reflected to some sense the thinking back then. So, you know, now mind you, I should also say, look, it's not as if there's any 18th Amendment of drug prohibition, which is going to be reappealed. There's not as if there's any Berlin Wall of drug prohibition that's just going to come tumbling down. What we're talking about here is a step-by-step, incremental process of trying to unravel and undo the worst excesses of drug prohibition. Mm-hmm. My organization, Drug Policy Alliance, we're the leading organization in the U.S., if not the world, of people trying to bring an end to the war on drugs. And we just had an amazing, probably the largest international gathering ever in the world last week in New Orleans. Orleans, over 1,000 people, you know, I mean, from all around the world, from all walks of life, all across the political spectrum, from libertarian right to left-wing left to everything in between, across the drug use spectrum, from people who love drugs to people who have been traumatized by drugs, people across the drug law spectrum, from former law enforcers to people who spend time behind bars. Only thing I agreed about was that the war on drugs is a failure and it needs to be revamped. Now, most of our resources are not going into these magazine articles about legalizing drugs or what have you. Most of it's going into working in states around the country, including Wisconsin, to try to pull back the excessive mandatory minimum sentences, to try to get rid of the racially unjust and disproportionate sentencing, to try to ensure that things like drug addiction are treated as a health issue, that we have clean needle programs in so that we can reduce the spread of AIDS and Hep C, so that people who are suffering in pain or with MS or what have you can get marijuana at least for medical purposes, so that school education programs are honest and reality-based rather than these farcical DARE programs that you still have around the United States. So a lot of the work is about these incremental reforms, working in state legislatures, working with PTAs, working in communities to try to have a more sensible and just drug policy, but always keeping in mind that we have to critically examine the basic prohibitionist system at its core.
Tom in Burlington is with us. Hi, Tom.
Yes, I'm familiar with a very successful businessman. He's a billionaire. His name is Peter Lewis. Peter Lewis, George Soros, and another gentleman, they're all billionaires, and they're trying to get medical marijuana enforced. Now, one of the problems I have in the little city town here of Burlington, we have 2.2 million people in jail, and there's another 5 million in the legal system. But if a man goes to work and tests positive for drugs, he's fired from his job. And so there are a lot of companies that can't hire people because they can't pass the drug test. And there's a lot of families here who can't get good jobs simply because they have remnants of marijuana in their blood system. And now one of the arguments against marijuana is that if you start out on marijuana, you'll go to the harder stuff. Well, I don't know if that's really true or not, but most people who are on drugs, they start out on milk. So I don't think that holds up very well.
Is milk a gateway drug, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it's funny. He's not the first person to say that. I mean, many people have pointed out that something like only one out of every 100 people who smoke marijuana land up going on to have a problem with heroin or cocaine. And they're trying to reduce heroin abuse by deterring marijuana use is more or less like trying to reduce motorcycle fatalities by discouraging bicycle riding among kids. That it's a highly inefficient and ineffective way to deal with this. I think the caller is also right about the drug testing. That, you know, this is another thing that is more and more profit-driven, almost in the same way that the prison industrial complex is. You have former law enforcement officials, former DEA officials who retire, and the first thing they do is set up a drug testing company. That's now become a multi-billion dollar industry, and much of this testing has nothing to do with safety or anything in the workplace. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you test positive for smoking marijuana on a Monday morning because you happen to smoke a joint on a Friday or Saturday night, that says nothing about your work performance. All it says is that the metabolites of marijuana continue to show up in a test longer than something like alcohol does. So we have a policy which lands up encouraging people to use more dangerous drugs, be it alcohol or cocaine, because they're less easy to detect, and meanwhile is discriminating against millions of Americans who would smoke marijuana in their private time, show up at work, be perfectly capable, but are being discriminated against and fired simply because of what they did in their own time. That's not right. It's not just. I wish there was an effective way to organize the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who have been victimized by these foolish policies.
Our guest is Ethan Nadelman. He is founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. He's author of a cover story that appeared recently in Foreign Policy magazine entitled Drugs. And in it, he says the global war on drugs cannot be won. The war on drugs is not working, and it's time to revamp it. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We wonder what you think, what questions you have. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up after 8 o'clock, several members of Congress are calling for an investigation into the CIA's destruction of tapes showing the interrogation of terror suspects, and also reportedly using the waterboarding technique. We will talk with a guest who says that investigate away, nothing was done wrong here. That's coming up after 8 o'clock. Ethan Nadelman, our guest this hour, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance and an author of the cover story in the September-October issue of Foreign Policy magazine, Drugs, talking about how drug prohibition has failed and how it's time to revamp the so-called war on drugs. Chris in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wondered to go along with the comments he had about the incremental approach, whether it would be politically best to not call for legalization but to work to dramatically change the consequences and have other consequences other than, in most cases, prison, tax consequences, an employee insurance rates, other social consequences. So that's my question.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is very much yes. I mean, I think, look, you can't control this. It's a free country. People can say what they want to do. There are people out there who are going to say that legalization is the answer, ending prohibition is the answer. And there's people like me who are saying we got to put that question on the table, and you still have magazine editors who are going to call it legalize it with an exclamation point, right? But I think the incremental aspect of this, trying to roll this stuff back, is pivotal. I've been in Wisconsin numerous times. I've debated your former DA, McCann. I met last year with the mayor of Milwaukee and with a guy, I think, who's now the district attorney, with members of the state legislature. There's a lot of openness. None of these people want to talk about legalization or go there. But when you sit down with people, you find that there is a willingness to look for new approaches. You have the Benedict Center in Milwaukee. It's a wonderful social justice, you know, organization headed by Kit McNally that's trying to simultaneously open up more debate but also move things in the right direction with more diversion programs, giving people more opportunities for treatment and rehabilitation when they get in trouble with the law in nonviolent ways. On the other hand, Wisconsin's legislature has been remarkably retrograde. Trying to get anything even incremental through there has been incredibly difficult. Now, my organization is Drug Policy Alliance. For those of you who want to get involved, the website's drugpolicy.org. The only way this is going to change is by building a movement to change this. We're working in the state legislatures, and we're also trying to do ballot initiatives in the states that will allow this. Incremental reform is the name of the game, but you always have to be willing to keep that big picture in mind. We can't just be chipping away at an oppressive system while acknowledging its legitimacy. There is something fundamentally illegitimate about drug prohibition. And even if legalization is not the ultimate answer for all drugs, we need to question the basic suppositions of prohibition itself.
Yeah, your article does question whether we can reduce the demand for drugs, saying that that's not really working either. So we went to the Office of National Drug Control Policy and found at least this announcement on the website that 860,000 fewer young people are using drugs today than there were in 2001, that the use of marijuana has decreased 25%, that ecstasy use is half of what it used to be, methamphetamine use has plummeted a staggering 64%. So does that mean something is working in education?
Well, you know, Joy, it's interesting because I'm looking today at in the New York Times, and I'm looking at the big article on the reform of crack sentencing, and then I'm looking at the piece about President Bush standing up and announcing what you just said. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, what it also points out is that the use of other drugs, including cocaine, was holding steady, and then narcotics like OxyContin and Vicodin remain in vogue. Mm-hmm. I think the good news in this thing was that the percentage of young people, eighth graders, who said that they used an illicit drug had dropped from 24% to 13% in the last 10 years. But if you look among 12th graders, right, you basically see a drop from 42 to 36%. And the odds are that in 2007, teenagers are less likely to admit to illicit drug use to a pollster than they were 10 years ago when the atmosphere was a little more open. But more broadly, it's important to realize that there's an ebb and flow in drug use trends. It's been true for decades, if not centuries. You know, drugs like marijuana or prescription drugs or cocaine or ecstasy, they go up and down over time, and that ultimately government policies have relatively little to do with that. They go up and down in the same reason that different fashions in music or hair lengths or clothing or food styles change over time. So the president decided that this was the year he was actually going to talk about it. Typically, when the numbers go up, he lets somebody else roll out the news. But, I mean, by and large, you have to look at this in a broader perspective. Drugs are omnipresent. I read somewhere recently that this may be the first year in which for more young people used a prescription drug than actually used marijuana. I think the bottom line is that if you're a teenager in America, you're going to have access to illicit drugs, whether it's in your parents' prescription, medicine cabinet with a prescription drugs, or whether it's marijuana or other drugs in school. And that ultimately, we're not going to be able to build a moat between our children and the drugs. That ultimately, we're not going to be creating a drug-free society. That ultimately, the real challenge, and I know it's hard to hear this, but that the real challenge is to accept the hard fact that drugs are here to stay, and that we really have no choice as individuals, families, and societies but to learn how to live with them so that they cause the least possible harm and, in some cases, the greatest possible good.
Next, we go to Amos in Sauk County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for the program. Mm-hmm. The problem I have with what you're saying, I mean, I'm opposed to all drugs in my personal life, but I support legalizing all drugs because to me it's an issue of living in a free society where you don't have society run by thugs and guns and prison industrial complexes and narco states and all of that. And I actually, if we ever got sane and legalized all drugs, I think actually marijuana would be a problem because it would lead a lot of people to apathy and things like that. So I actually see in a rational society that would be the issue. And the problem I have with what you're saying is that you're not willing to say we need to legalize all drugs, including heroin, anything you talk about. And I'm not even interested in state support for programs to help people that are on drugs. You know, I support helping people on drugs, but once you get the state involved and you once again get a vested interest in it, and it seems to me that a rational program getting at the real problem, which is the destruction of our freedoms and the violence in our culture and the lack of personal responsibility, is to say these are the real issues. It's not whether marijuana is good for you or bad for you or how it works, but with the logic of what we're saying, we need to legalize everything and let people take their own responsibility for their actions and let the rest of the people that want to lead their own lives in a peaceful and rational manner are not controlled by these outer forces. And
yeah. No, you know, I'm just going to say that, I mean, you're making good points. I think where I agree with you basically about 75%, I do think that basically the issues of freedom is the most important issue we're talking about here. But at the same time, I also think it's important to think about this as a health issue and as a public health issue. And my objective ultimately is not just to reduce the harms of drug prohibition, you know, the crime, corruption, violence, evisceration of civil liberties and what have you. It's also to reduce the harms of drugs. And so my ultimate drug policy, the best drug policy to my mind, is one that seeks to reduce the harms both of drug prohibition and the harms of drugs. Now, it's possible that a full-out legalization policy like you suggest may be the one that accomplishes that. I actually think it's going to be some mixture of sensible regulation, decriminalization, and public health. I think that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that when I think about the issue of whether or not government should spend taxpayer money to help people who are getting in problem with drugs, I basically look at this as a matter of what's a sensible investment. If you can see that the government spending, you know, $1 billion to increase access to rehabilitation and treatment is going to help many lives and save double, triple, or quadruple that in wasted money on prison costs or law enforcement costs, then that's, I think, a good decision. Think about government not just as the problem, which it sometimes is, and in the drug war it very much is, but think about government as a way to use taxpayer resources as efficiently as possible. And if that's the way you think about it, then you say put the money, decriminalize, yes, legalize, yes, tax and regulate, yes, but also invest the money where it's going to produce the greatest gain for the society.
Yeah. Let's conclude, Ethan Nadelman, with the news of the day and what effect you think this decision over, shining the spotlight on the differences in sentences for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, what this is going to mean for your efforts?
Well, a number of things. I mean, the first one, of course, is that thousands of people who are serving incredibly long and unjust sentences in federal prisons are going to have a chance to have their sentences reconsidered, and some thousands of them, certainly not all of them or not even a majority, but thousands will, in fact, be let out early, be able to return to their family, and in many cases, actually actually to legitimate livelihoods. So that's a very positive, direct, and humanitarian impact. I think the second thing it's going to do is it's going to inspire many of the states to reexamine their own mandatory minimum laws and sentencing guidelines. Because keep in mind that those 500,000 people behind bars on drug charges tonight in America, roughly 20% or less than that, maybe 100,000 are in federal prisons. The rest are in state prisons and local jails. So I hope we'll see some serious reconsideration, including in Wisconsin. A few years ago, my organization worked with local activists in the state of Connecticut to get rid of the crack powder distinction, and that made a real difference. It helps people a lot. I think, thirdly, I think it's going to put this issue a bit into the national debate. There has not been much debate about drug policy in the presidential elections, campaigns, and what have you, and I think that this is going to require people to speak out and take a stand on this stuff. We're going to see where does Hillary Clinton stand. We're going to see where do other Democratic candidates, where the Republican candidates stand. I'm curious to see what a guy like Huckabee is going to say on this sort of stuff. So I think we're going to see more discussion, more debate, and we're going to see if we've matured as a political culture and a society to the point where we can now talk about these sensibly, talk about the drug laws and drug problems sensibly today in a way that was not possible 20 years ago.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Ethan Nadelman, founder, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, author of a recent cover story in Foreign Policy magazine on drugs and why the war on drugs is not working. You can talk more about drugs and the crack cocaine, powder cocaine sentencing after 2 on Talk of the Nation. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.